You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. My name is Josh Gerstein. I'm a White House reporter for Politico, and I want to welcome everyone to this Brookings Institution Campaign 2012 discussion on terrorism issues and the 2012 election. This is part of a series of discussions Brookings has been having, moderated by Politico, talking about a variety of different issue areas that are coming up, or in some cases maybe not coming up in the presidential election, and exactly why they are and what points there are of the most interest in the campaign. The format for these discussions has been to have a paper written by one of the scholars here at Brookings, usually, as well as a couple of responses laying out sort of questions or thoughts or a critique of the initial paper. So we're joined here today by, starting to my immediate right, Ben Wittes, who is a senior fellow here at Brookings. He wrote the main paper we're going to be talking about today, along with Daniel Byman, a fellow at the Saban Center. He's best known to me, however, as the founder, one of the founders of the Lawfare blog, which is sort of required reading for anybody like me who does a lot of writing about national security and terrorism issues. To his right, we have Stephen Grand from the Brookings Institution, another fellow here who works in the area of U.S. relations with the Islamic world. And then we have Hafiz Ghanem, who is also a senior fellow at Brookings and is basically standing in for a couple other people who wrote some of the one of the other responses to Ben's paper offering a critique of how the U.S. should go forward on some of these terrorism issues, especially in the next term, whether that be one that's a second term for President Obama or a first term for a President Mitt Romney. We thought we'd start off the discussion today just sort of talking about how we got to this place in the presidential campaign and to the discussion of terrorism. I imagine you can always find just about someone who predicted just about anything, but it would have been hard to predict that we'd be right where we are right now in terms of where this issue is in the campaign and how it's playing. The general consensus at the moment is that national security and terrorism are an issue where President Obama has a pretty substantial advantage over his challenger, Mitt Romney. There's a debate about how significant the issue rates compared with other issues like the economy, but most folks seem to feel that it's an area where Obama feels he has a pretty strong advantage, which is a pretty surprising development if you think about where we were just about 4 years ago, 3 to 4 years ago. I've covered these issues over the course of the first term, and terrorism is really an issue where President Obama was on the ropes for the first couple years of his administration. His plan to close Guantanamo sort of was thrown back right off the bat by members of Congress and never really recovered its footing, and was eventually sort of quietly basically disposed of by the administration by the end of 2010, the beginning of 2011. There was sort of a public relations debacle over the effort to try terrorism suspects in New York City, and there were some pretty close calls in the terrorism area, particularly the Christmas Day bombing attempt of a flight inbound to Detroit that could have been a very, very serious disaster, and one where the administration's reaction was not seen as particularly sure-footed. So it's pretty amazing that we're here just about 2 months before the next election, and it's somehow seen that the president has an advantage on these terrorism issues. I guess the main event that hasn't been mentioned would be the killing of Osama bin Laden in May 2011, as well as basically the president abandoning some of the policies that were so controversial earlier in his term. But I thought we'd start with you, Ben. Maybe you want to add some other factors about how we've gotten to this place where the Democrats seem to think that terrorism and national security issues are such an advantage for them that they can basically wave them like a big flag at their convention. And it often seems that Mitt Romney and the Republicans are, if not quite on the run over those issues, silent to the point where Mitt Romney didn't mention Afghanistan and seemed to basically gloss over this whole area that was seen for decades as a real advantage for Republicans.
Well, thanks, Josh. So thank you all for coming out. It's kind of heartwarming to see a large group of people get together to talk about an issue that actually isn't playing significantly in an election. And because there was a time when we actually all thought counterterrorism was kind of important. Jokes aside, I think Josh has really hit on the sort of central paradox for both parties of the way this issue is playing in the election, which is, I think 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, none of us would have predicted that this would be an issue that the president would be talking about in his acceptance speech at his convention, and the Republican candidate would not be talking about in his acceptance speech at his convention. I don't think any of us, I certainly would not have predicted that, and I don't know a lot of people who would either. When you look at the poll data, it suggests, first of all, that this is an issue that the president's handling of foreign policy in general, but terrorism in particular. Terrorism, he polls much, much more strongly on terrorism, handling of terrorism, than he does on handling of other things, including the economy. So in one poll, for example, nearly 65% of people said they approved of his handling of terrorism issue. That is a very substantial strength for him. He tends to poll better than Romney on this on the specific question. And again, he also tends to poll in absolute terms rather high. And so it's become an area of real strength for him. Now, this is a problem for the Republican Party in the sense that running candidates who are supposedly tough and campaigning on the basis of the supposed weakness of Democratic candidates is kind of a mainstay of Republican presidential campaigning. It's very awkward for the Republican Party to be sort of outflanked on this. On the other hand, I also think that there's a paradox in it for Obama, and one that has governance implications in going forward should he be reelected. And they are as follows. You know, Obama came into office wanting to make a big change and to make a big splash in this issue. But the splash he wanted to make was that he was going to be the guy who closed Guantanamo, restored the rule of law, got us out of Iraq, ended torture, and did counterterrorism according to our values. Right now, he did a lot of those things, and you know, we can talk about that. There's a lot, you know, he has some sort of solid accomplishments along those lines. But those are not actually the reason why he's polling at 65%. On this handling of terrorism. And the reason he's polling that high and the reason that he's talking about it at his in his convention speech and his opponent is not is that his launch ramped up drone strikes, killed a lot of people, that he's killed two particular people in particular. One is Osama bin Laden and the other is Anwar al-Awlaki. And that the second of those people is a U.S. citizen. And the result of the aggregate of these very strong, very aggressive actions is that he's come off as a tough guy. And so you have the Republican Party has been sort of deprived of the place that it expected to be. But in a significant respect, Obama is also not talking about this issue the way I suspect he suspected he wanted to be talking about it at this point either. Now, I don't mean to say that's an unfortunate position for him to be in the sense that you'd certainly rather be the guy who got Osama bin Laden than not. On the other hand, what it does highlight is that his record in operational counterterrorism is dramatically stronger than his record in doing the set of things that he came into office wanting to do in this space. And those efforts, which Josh alluded to in his introduction, bring up a real area of failure on the part of this administration, which is that it came in wanting to fundamentally change the framework in which it was going to be operating. And it has done a much better job of confronting al-Qaeda than it has done in confronting the Congress of the United States in kind of creating that framework. And so you have until the end of last year with the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act, an almost continuing series of you know, antler-locking clashes between Congress and the presidency over the course of the Obama administration that he has not managed to get real control over. And I think the challenge for him, should he be reelected going forward, the challenges for Romney would be rather different. But the challenges for Obama would be really, how do you settle these relations with Congress in a fashion that would be even remotely as successful as you've been in confronting the enemy?
Ben, I just wanted to start by asking you on this, since we're on the issue of sort of the political ramifications here. Many of us have been trying mightily to figure out what Mitt Romney's policies are on some of these terrorism-related issues. He struggled, obviously, at the convention as a result of not having mentioned Afghanistan. But when you get into some of the specifics of either the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy or terrorism policy more generally, it seems somewhat hard to pin him down. You mentioned one in your paper that he favors recodifying or coming up with an extended version of the AUMF. We're about to have these presidential debates where I'm told that perhaps as much as half of the time is supposed to be devoted to foreign policy issues, which presumably includes terrorism issues. Where do you see, presumably Romney's going to have to try to differentiate himself from the president in some way. Where do you see the Republicans having a direction to go here that could sell to voters?
Well, it's a really difficult problem for them. The areas that they've tried in the past are to oppose trials in federal court for terrorist suspects, which is actually really not a good idea, you know, to oppose the tool that you are likely to have to use repeatedly and that both the current administration and the former administration has used repeatedly as a sort of mainstay of particularly on the domestic side, how you handle terrorist suspects. The support of military commissions is part of the answer to that, I suppose, except that, of course, Obama is now conducting military commissions in, and so that doesn't really differentiate you from the opponent. You can, as Romney has sort of flirted with in the past, focus on the interrogation side and try to differentiate yourself. Well, he ended enhanced interrogation. I'm really an enthusiast of sort of, you know, sleep deprivation and waterboarding, but it's not really clear that that's sort of a winning. I mean, it is clear, by the way, that when you poll people, people tend to like that stuff much better, more than elites do. But as a presidential, and it was a big, you know, you'll recall during the Republican primaries, there was sort of an, you know, I love waterboarding more than you. No, I love waterboarding more than you thing going on for a while. But I think, you know, in the sort of run-up to an actual general election, that stuff would probably play pretty badly. And in addition, there haven't actually been, at a more serious level, there have not been any recent cases that I know of that you could even plausibly say we have had operational setbacks as a result of sort of insufficient aggressiveness in interrogation. And so that there isn't really a there, even if you put aside all the moral concerns and the legal concerns. And the result is that, I think you do have this problem of what you should talk about as the Republican candidate. And the result in Romney's case has been really to talk about it as little as possible, which, as I say, is very awkward for him. And I think underlying that is the fact that, you know, both sides really want there to be a great difference between them on this issue, and it just isn't there. And so you end up with certain things that, for example, neither candidate is going to close Guantanamo. You know, one candidate says he's committed to closing Guantanamo, and one candidate says he's committed to keeping Guantanamo. But we know that Obama is not actually going to do it, and we know that Romney isn't going to do it. And so the voter kind of has this sense that there's much less difference than there may be rhetorically, especially because Obama isn't really talking much about closing Guantanamo these days. And there are a lot of issues like that. Both candidates are very enthusiastic about you know, attacking the enemy with drones. Both candidates, as a practical matter, will use both military commissions and federal court trials to try the enemy. Both candidates will reserve the right to hold detainees in military custody without charges at all under certain circumstances. And both will probably try to reduce to a minimum the number of circumstances in which they have to do that. And, you know, neither candidate is really moving aggressively against talking about how we shouldn't, the NSA shouldn't be conducting, you know, the sort of surveillance that used to be very controversial before the FISA Amendments Act. And so I do think you have, underlying Romney's silence, a real convergence between the candidates that makes it very hard for him to identify what the areas that he would really differentiate himself in this space look like.
Do you think a President Mitt Romney would be more likely to detain someone on U.S. soil outside the traditional judicial legal system?
I think, you know, so this is a great hypothetical situation in the case of both candidates. Obama has basically said he won't do it, though he does not forswear the legal authority to do it. He just says he won't. Romney hasn't, to my knowledge, said anything like that. As a practical matter, no president after the Hamdi and Padilla and Al-Mari cases is going to be looking for a test case with which to do that. And so you're going to be looking to figure out a way to deal with such a person in the criminal justice system, and so far we have always found one. So hypothetically, I think Romney might be more willing to contemplate it, but in practice, their behavior is going to be exactly the same. They're going to look at the detainee in front of them, and they're going to say, can we make a criminal case? They're going to find a way to make the criminal case, and the issue's not going to arise. Now, it is, I agree, Romney may have more conceptual willingness to do that than Obama, but I doubt you're ever going to see it tested, at least not as long as the numbers stay very small in terms of the number of people you're arresting domestically.
And the bureaucratic institutional pressures from within the government would be to stay the course with the way these things are usually handled.
You know, we have, it's not 2002 anymore. In 2002, we did not have very developed systems for when you pull somebody off a plane that you have intel from the intelligence community about and you got to do something with him. That provokes a real panic. And, you know, we've stood up the National Security Division at the Justice Department. We have all kinds of routine cooperation between intelligence agencies and law enforcement, all designed to ameliorate that problem and to make sure that when you have to confront that person, you can do it in a fashion that secures your intelligence interests without compromising your law enforcement interests. Those systems are not perfect. There are trade-offs. But so far, they have not resulted in a situation like Padilla or Al-Mari, where we simply could not proceed with the law enforcement case, and it was unthinkable to let the person go.
I want to ask you one thing about your paper before we move on to the reactions to your paper. Your paper talks a lot about what the next president should do in terms of trying to reach a meeting of the minds with Congress on how to proceed on some of these issues like detention, probably also dealing with the AUMF, which is the authorization for use of military force, which is basically pretty much the only operative congressional enactment that we have dealing with a lot of these issues related to terrorism. Why do you think reaching an accommodation between the executive branch and the legislative branch here is so important? Why do you think it maybe wouldn't be a panacea for these problems, but why do you think it would be such a solve? Because I could see people saying, look, Congress, as of the August 2012 Gallup poll, has a 10% approval rating. Most of its forays into this area when it has proposed riders or legislation, a lot of experts view a lot of those efforts as either exceedingly unwise and sometimes almost comical in their ham-handedness. Why is it so important for the president to try to get a congressional stamp of approval for some of these policies? Why not just have the executive branch continue to work out these policies and let the elections, presidential elections or whatever, serve as some sort of referendum validating them. Why go through this complicated dance with Congress?
Well, so first of all, you have to go through the complicated dance with Congress because Congress forces you to, right? I mean, if Congress were willing to, as it did for a lot of the Bush administration in certain areas, simply sit back and say, you take responsibility for the outcomes, we'll keep our mouths shut, we won't say don't do it, but we also reserve the right to say bad things about you if things go badly, then that becomes a viable option. And the problem is that starting in response to the Guantanamo closure plan, that was not a game that Congress was willing to play anymore. And Congress passed a series of restrictions on the president's ability to transfer people out of Guantanamo, including to the United States for criminal process. And so there was a very deliberate and active effort on Congress's part to get involved in a way that requires, if you're serious about doing any of these things, that you engage with Congress merely at least as a defensive proposition in order to not have these options cut off. Secondly, and I think sort of less situationally or kind of more fundamentally, it is not a healthy thing for to go years and years and years with the essential contours of very robust executive actions done on the basis of nebulous statutory or sometimes no statutory authority. Any time you can have the Congress of the United States behind you, even with a 10% approval rating, you would much rather, as president, have a federal statute saying you're within your rights to do this very controversial thing than not. The Bush administration suffered just terribly for not getting Congress on board some things that they really would have been prepared to do had they been asked. And the Obama administration, sometimes against its will, actually, has been, through this back and forth with Congress, has actually built some more durable architecture that I think is a sort of very salutary thing, including in litigation that they have going on, you know, every day.
I should mention, I said the AUMF was probably the only big piece of legislation. The FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments in 2008 that the president, as a senator and candidate, voted for was also a pretty significant piece of legislation, essentially validating the NSA program or putting it into a legislative framework.
And you have the Military Commissions Act of 2009 as well, which I think is a very important piece of legislation in bringing the Democratic Party on board the fundamental architecture by which we are likely to end up trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the 9/11, I suppose I should say alleged 9/11 conspirators.
Stephen, let's move to you, and we're going to sort of change the discussion a little bit here and I think talk more about what one might call more strategic or long-term proactive kinds of responses that the administration. Do you want to say something
directly about that? Sure. Can I just ask a question, Ben?
Because
I'm intrigued by some of what you said. Does this mean, though, that we've sort of reached a bipartisan consensus on where American foreign policy, at least in this particular area, should be sort of post 9/11?
Well, everybody wants to deny. Both parties ferociously want to deny that such a consensus exists, because the consensus actually violates both parties' essential self-image. You know, the Democratic Party, I'm going to caricature this just for fun, but I think you'll recognize some truth in both caricatures, right? Democratic Party sees itself as, we're the party of the rule of law, you know, we're the people who live our values, who believe that security and liberty are not at odds and that we can do well by doing good, right? And that the other party is the party of macho aggressiveness and doesn't think about the place that we're going to occupy in the world and our image in the world and human rights and all that stuff. And the Republican Party looks at it and says, well, we're the party of toughness and we're the party that understands that whether something is good and in your interests may not be the same, and we're the party that, you know, has the discipline to do what is necessary, even if it's not popular, and that the Democratic Party is weak, right? These are very, very deeply self, you know, in you know, deepen the self-images of the respective political movements. And so I think it's hard for both sides to understand the degree of consensus that actually does exist. And the degree of consensus that exists is the following. One is we are going to use both law enforcement and war powers on a systematic, sustained level for the foreseeable future in confronting terrorism. We're going to use war powers overseas. We're going to use law enforcement powers, chiefly domestically, but also overseas. The second is those war powers include both the power to target with lethal force people we consider to be part of the enemy, and the power to detain subject to the laws of war, not subject to the laws of the criminal justice system, those we capture. Third, we're going to be very aggressively surveilling all kinds of people in the course of doing those two things. Fourth, we're going to use certain hybrid tools for those that we do capture. We may use, you know, military trials for some of them. We may use civilian trials for some of them. And those decisions are largely going to be matters of executive convenience. And then finally, I think the other sort of core element of the consensus, and this is a political consensus, you know, policy consensus, not a legal consensus, is that we're going to be on offense. And we're going to be doing as much offense as possible on the basis of standoff robotic platforms, because that saves our people from getting hurt. And I think neither Mitt Romney nor Barack Obama, put in this room under sodium pentothal, would disagree with a word of that. And I think the reason they have so much trouble figuring out what to disagree about is that they both basically, and a huge percentage of both of their parties, actually operationally don't dissent from a word of that.
Do you think it's fair to describe that as a George W. Bush term to consensus on what we should be doing, what the defaults should be on a lot of these policies?
Well, you're definitely right to distinguish between Bush term one and term two. Bush moved a lot and he changed. And Obama has gone further down the road that Bush was already moving in the latter part of his second term. And I don't think you would see, so I see it more as a continuation of the directional momentum of the late Bush administration. The Bush administration learned a lot of lessons over the course of its time in office, and Obama learned lessons from the Bush administration's time in office. I think largely those have gelled around a certain degree of consensus, and I think the Bush administration was moving in that direction. I think Obama made some important innovations to further it down the road.
Hafez, do you have any thoughts, before we go to the formal responses, do you have any thoughts about Ben's statements on where the consensus stands?
Well, my thought, which I probably also delivered more later, is that the whole debate on counterterrorism is too narrow. It just misses a huge set of issues that need to be tackled. Yes, the security aspects, yes, the war effort aspects, and the legal aspects and so on are important, and they have to be done with. But there are all the other issues, economic issues, social issues, political issues, that need to be tackled. What I would have liked to see, actually, is a debate on how with all the changes happening now in the Arab world, how can we change, how can we seize the opportunity to use those changes to fight terrorism? Because I see what is going on now with the Arab Spring and the revolutions as creating a great opportunity and also a great risk. And that's where I would like to see the debate in the U.S. going.
So, Stephen, why don't we start in on that a little bit? You know, you discussed in your paper some of that issue, mm-hmm. how the U.S. can take advantage of the Arab Spring. You know, you paint the U.S., I think, a little bit as sort of a bystander that this Arab Spring kind of happened to. I think from the U.S. perspective, it's probably actually a little bit worse than that. I think a lot of folks in the Arab world saw, as I covered the first couple years of the Obama administration, them actually reinforcing some of these rather despotic regimes. In fact, the effort to jumpstart the Arab-Israeli peace process was largely pursued by fortifying leaders in the Arab world in places like Mubarak's Egypt. You know, the president went to Cairo with a speech that wasn't really focused on fomenting dramatic change in Cairo, but in Egypt, but with other goals. Even people that, you know, who may not be discussed in polite company anymore, like President Assad, were the recipients of efforts to sort of romance them diplomatically during the early months and year of this administration, all of which has been now sort of dumped as the Arab Spring has been, as the U.S. and the administration has attempted to adopt the Arab Spring. I guess what I would say to you is, does the U.S. have the credibility in the Arab world to be a proponent of democracy and this Arab Spring movement, or does it have to try to take advantage of it in a more subtle way? The sense I get from the administration is they feel that the latter is the case, that they can't full-on try to take advantage of it, but have to do it much more carefully because the U.S. credibility as a result of various things, dating back to the Bush administration and earlier, is kind of damaged there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the big question on the table is Ben, within this institution, deals with the bad guys and sort of how do you deal with terrorism? The project that I run looks at how do you engage with the 99.9% of Muslims who have nothing to do with al-Qaeda and in many cases believe that he's usurped a religion. And what does that engagement look like? And the Arab Spring, I think, has created these new opportunities for America and perils for America to engage in a different way with the peoples of at least the Middle East and North Africa. And to your point, I think there is some reticence to get too out in front for fear that our prior reputation will undermine legitimate voices in the region that are pushing for change. But on the other hand, you're also seeing a great deal of disillusionment within the region about our reluctance to move more boldly, Syria being the most obvious and most recent example, where it's felt that America, particularly an American president who talked about returning to American values, is turning a blind eye or at least not doing enough to counter what is a tyrant turning on his own people and killing them.
And have you detected any differences on those policies between the Obama and Romney campaigns or their rhetoric?
Well, you know, interestingly, as someone who cares deeply about what's happening in Syria, I kind of wish that both campaigns were talking about this more, that this was more of an issue, because I think if it were, we would be seeing more pressure for there to be a more forward-looking U.S. policy. But Romney hasn't really moved that much from the administration's position.
Do you think he's caught... the GOP candidate, Governor Romney, is caught in a sense between two wings of his party, one a traditionally hawkish kind of wing, perhaps represented by Senator McCain, for example, and another wing, which is the Tea Party wing, which is seen as, I don't know how powerful they are, but they're seen as resurgent and powerful, and I think tend to have a more, maybe isolationist is too strong a word, but they tend to be more skeptical about U.S. military involvements and foreign policy involvements, and that Romney is trying to reap the votes of both those constituencies. And the moment he gets more specific about that issue or even some of the issues Ben's talking about, the moment he takes a position, he starts to undermine his standing with one of those constituencies. Is that part of what's going on here?
It's perhaps part of it, but I think the larger issue that's only becoming clearer and clearer over time is the Russians have really put down a red line on this issue. And so both for the administration and for Romney as a candidate, this has become an issue that's now larger than Syria. This is an issue of what do you do when you have a human rights crisis on your hands and a major power within the Security Council does not want to go along, potentially two major powers within the Security Council don't want to go along. Do you push forward or not? Knowing that if you push forward, there could be some huge fallout in terms of longer-term relations with Russia, longer-term relations with China, the sort of balance of power within the world.
Hafez, the paper you're speaking for here today talks about development and the youth movements, the population challenges, demographic challenges, I think, in many parts of the world and how they contribute to the problem of terrorism. Just to come at it from a skeptical point of view, which is the way we reporters often do these things, you know, it seems that the problem with al-Qaeda, I don't know if it's getting worse, but it seems to be metastasizing. It seems to be moving from one part of the world to another part of the world. You know, what seemed to be originating from one area now seems to be spreading from North Africa down into Africa. You have these areas in Yemen and Somalia that people are concerned about. It often seems like almost any ungovernable or ungoverned space in the world becomes sort of a home that al-Qaeda can inhabit. Isn't that a tremendously formidable problem to try to tackle through improving the development of the poor all over the world? It just seems like, however laudable that goal may be and however wise it may be for the U.S. and others in the Western world to invest in that, is it really an effective strategy of combating terrorism?
It's actually cheaper than building all those fancy drones. if you look at the amount of money spent on defense compared to what goes for fighting poverty, it is what goes to fighting poverty is dwarfed. So I actually think that in the long run, I'm not saying that the defense part is not important. I think given where we are now, we have to invest in it. But in the long run, we need to tackle the real issues. And the real issues, let me give you a few facts. I mean, the project that I'm running is looking at the transition in the Arab countries and the economic transition in the Arab countries. And one of the questions that we asked ourselves is, how do you explain the Arab revolts? And actually, when you ask this question, it also explains, it also helps you define the factors that make those countries such a right place for al-Qaeda and others. And let me just give you four stylized facts. The first one is that those countries are mostly young. You have 55% of the population of the Arab world that is less than 24 years old. Two-thirds of the population is less than 30 years old. That although those countries spend a lot of money on education, actually the quality of their education system is very poor. And when they do those global tests for maths and sciences, and the 14 Arab countries that participate in those tests, not one of them, not one, scored the average. They're all way below average. And if you look at the youth situation, they have the highest rate of youth unemployment in the world. Take an example of Egypt, the largest of those countries. 70%, there are 850,000 new entrants in the labor market of Egypt every year. 70% of them have high school or above education. And those guys, it takes them about 5 years to find a job. And for those of them who find a job, three-quarters find jobs only in the informal sector. So they have their occasional workers, and they have no job security, no social benefits, and so on. So this is one fact. You have this huge youth population that sees very little opportunities for them. Second fact, and it has to do with the politics, that those same young people do not have any way of expressing themselves, of participating in the social and political lives in their countries. There was a survey done in Egypt in 2005 for a student group, for example, to publish a pamphlet in the university. It takes them 6 months because they have to go through all different layers of clearances by the security people. The only avenue that was open for them was through the Islamist groups. And some of those Islamist groups did good work. I mean, they build libraries, they help the young people do some volunteer work with the poor and so on. But some of them also spread crazy ideas. And that same survey found that the majority of young people in Egypt had views that were not tolerant, and especially not tolerant to people with different religions, different faiths, and so on. So you had a whole political system that suppressed young people and bred intolerance. Third fact, a huge sense of unfairness. I was looking, before coming here, I was looking at a paper by Gallup, which was done a year ago, on Tunisia. Tunisia has been growing fast. Egypt has been growing fast in terms of GDP and so on. And if you look at the superimposed two graphs, one graph is GDP per capita growth in Tunisia, which is an upward sloping line. And another graph is their question, asking people, are you thriving? Which is a downward sloping line. How do you explain this? He explains this is that the majority of those countries, like everywhere in the world, are middle class. And the middle class has been totally left out of the growth equation. Tunisia is fairly rich, but if you look at Yemen or you look at Egypt, 85% of what is considered middle class actually live on less than $4 a day. And this is your middle class. And if you look at the data on income distribution over the last few years, it is the size of the number of people who are rich or living on more than $14 a day has actually not changed. So it's not like, so the middle class has been suppressed all of this time. So there is this big sense of unfairness. Add to this a lot of, I don't want to talk too much, but a lot of cronyism and corruption, which made the sense of unfairness even bigger. And then there is also a sense, there's a point that is important. You mentioned it briefly. There is a sense of international unfairness. And that is especially linked to the Palestinian issue and the Arab-Israeli conflict. So you have those four facts that are actually that creates ripe, so that zero, all you need is are one or two crazies to go a blow a place. And as Steve was saying, you're 0.01%. If you have 0.01% of the population who subscribe to Al Qaeda views, that is already very dangerous. So this is if you really want to deal with terrorism, I believe that you need to have a policy, yes, that includes defense issues, but it includes a partnership for development, and not just any development, but inclusive development and fairness. That includes a partnership for democracy, and that includes a partnership for peace, trying to find a resolution for the Palestinian Arab-Israeli issues. And you cannot just focus on one aspect and not all of the others. Now, to end, the success of the current transition in the Arab countries will have a huge impact on whether we get more or less terrorism in the future. If it fails, if those countries fail and they become failed states, as you rightly said, you create vacuums where Al-Qaeda thrives. We've seen it in Sinai as the Egyptian transition was having trouble and the Egyptian government was weakening and weakening. We found all those groups who found bases, created bases in Sinai. The same thing in Yemen. So it is very. So it's a real danger that if this transition fails, we can end up with more terrorist bases around the region. On the other hand, if the success of this transition will help change this current situation, will help change the stature of the United States in the region, and the nature of the relations and the way that Arabs think of the United States.
How tight and direct do you think the relationship is, Hafez, between development and terrorism? Because you know, and the paper itself acknowledges that many of the individuals who've carried out terrorist acts have been middle class. Some of them seem to have been maybe even above or upper middle class. And if you want to be totally Machiavellian about it, there's probably some people who would say that, you know, a little bit of education is a dangerous thing. Somebody who's totally uneducated is probably not going to be able to pull off a sophisticated, you know, underwear bombing aboard an aircraft because they have difficulty comporting themselves correctly to get on there. It does seem like a lot of the people that carry out these attacks have studied in London, or their father was the head of the oil ministry, or stories along those lines. You don't hear so many about, you know, people who were shepherds coming out and suddenly becoming a suicide bomber. What is your answer to folks who say, look, I don't think there's really any real connection?
No, there is a connection. But you're right. The issue is not just, that's why I said you have four, you need to have a four-pronged approach. And you need to deal with the social, political issues, not just the economic ones. First of all, the middle class business, when you say middle class, you have to, a middle class person in, say, Yemen will be extremely poor person compared to us here. And then the issue also of on education. For me, education is not just learning to use a computer or this or that, but also an education system teaches you the basic your basic rights of being a citizen. And it teaches you civic. There's a part of civic education. All of this is missing in a system that is autocratic, that is trying to make sure that everybody follows the leadership rules and so on. You do not get this education. And what happens is exactly what the survey, this 2005 survey shows. It builds a whole generation of people that are partially educated, that have very xenophobic views, and find difficulty in interacting and respecting others, people with other views from other backgrounds.
One more thing, and just from you, Stephen or Hafez, to respond to, because it does relate to the campaign. One area where President, the man who hopes to be President, Mitt Romney, has made his position fairly clear is that he's in the camp of people that believes the U.S. needs to be more explicit about talking about the threat of terrorism as emanating from Islamic radicalism, and that there's an element of political correctness in the unwillingness of the Obama administration and many U.S. policymakers to publicly talk about Islam, an aberrant form of Islam being the cause of terrorism. Do you think that he would follow through on that? Do you think he would move more to the Bush second term formulation, which was where they sort of abandoned some of those ideas and went for sort of a softer approach? Do you think he's just blowing smoke on that? And what would be the impact if the U.S. Started speaking more directly about Islamic terrorism being the threat?
I think it's, you know, to denigrate an entire religion based on the acts of a few is a poor policy. You know, to go about trying to go about inflaming the views of 1.4 billion people because there were a set of crazies operating in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the other parts of the Maghreb and the Arabian Peninsula who have a very particular, very warped view of a particular religion. It's just a mistake. I think that probably comes from pressure within his party, the right wing of his party, to make this a political issue. But I think it's one is misguided and two is not bad policy.
I also think, just break in, that it's very unfair to Norwegian white supremacy. We've had a couple of like really dramatic terrorist attacks that should stand for the idea that this is a problem without a particular, ethnic or religious or regional badge on it, and I think it's possible to keep in mind the idea, at least as pertains to the exercise of war powers, that Congress has authorized the use of force against certain groups and not other groups, right? And so when you think about who is the United States fighting a war against, that will actually frame it in not anti-Islamic terms, but the United States has authorized, the Congress of the United States has authorized the use of force against Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces, all of which are Islamic groups of one sort or another. That said, to confuse confuse that with the problem being one that's essentially religious in nature is going to, as Steve says, smear a lot of people. It's also going to miss a lot of terrorists.
But I think the critics of that position would say something like the Fort Hood shooting. You had indications of a potential terrorist attack that were overlooked out of an abundance of political correctness, where people were so fearful of being labeled as anti-Islamic bigots that they didn't say things that they should have said about a colleague who was acting in a very aberrant kind of way.
Oh, they may even be right about that. If you have somebody who's talking in a very violent way, as Nidal Hassan appears to have been, animated by whatever concerns, and you suppress those concerns because you're afraid of an allegation of prejudice against the group that he is speaking on in a very violent, extreme way, as purporting to represent, I suppose you've probably earned the criticism, but that does not mean that that group alone is the problem, and it doesn't mean that. You can reverse engineer a lot of bad logic out of that, and I think there's, when you look around the United States, the spate of shootings that have happened recently have also been a reminder that. And again, what you want to define as terrorism and what you want to define as really bad incidents of violent crime, gets into a definitional question that's probably not availing or very interesting. But I do think that there are real reminders that this is not a set of problems that we need to, that we should principally think about in, religious or ethnic terms.
Hafez, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I would say that, if we look at this as a medium to long run issue that needs to be resolved, it is in the interest of the United States to be seen as partnering with the people. The U.S. has been seen as partnering with the autocratic leaders and supportive of the autocratic leaders for all those years. And as a result, today, it has very little credibility among the people. I was looking at a poll that shows that 70% of Egyptians would prefer not to receive any economic aid from the United States. And this is a country that's going bankrupt. This just gives you a feel for the extent of the bad blood there. And you want to change that. it is important that you change that. And you will not succeed in doing that by starting to label them all as a group as being your enemy.
And it should be a partnership about governance. I mean, if you look at some of the real problems of Muslim-majority countries, it's been governance. It's been really, really poor governance where we've aligned with the bad guys, with the poor leaders. And we have a chance with the Arab Spring to sort of rearrange the deck a little bit and play a different role. And let's play a positive role in trying to change educational systems, but even more trying to change political systems.
Ben, let me just ask you one thing, and then we'll go to audience questions in a minute. I want to switch back a little bit to the more concrete sort of areas that are under direct U.S. authority and U.S. Control of the U.S. legal system and the executive branch. On Guantanamo, in your paper towards the end, you throw a little bit of a hand grenade and say not only should Guantanamo be kept open, but it should be expanded. And I'm wondering if you might tell us briefly why it is you think that Guantanamo should be expanded, which I think is probably a fairly unusual position among the think tank set here in Washington. And also, does that mean that you disbelieve the very earnest pronouncements from all levels of the U.S. government that Guantanamo is the number one recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda?
All right, so the second question is easy. Yes, I disbelieve that Guantanamo is the number one or even an especially significant recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda. I'm actually, my co-author, Dan Byman, is actually better positioned to talk about the role that Guantanamo plays in Al-Qaeda propaganda than I am. But my basic feeling is the relevant question is, are you holding people in extra criminal detention? If you are, whatever the facility you do that in will be a bad word in certain circles, and you're just going to have to live with that. And if you move them to Thompson, Illinois, people will find out that Thompson means very much the same thing that Guantanamo. And once you've decided you're going to engage in certain types of detention, there's going to be public relations consequences to that. And you have to price that into your decision to do it. I think where you do it makes very, very little difference. That's just my opinion. So let me clarify. When Obama said he was going to close Guantanamo, I did not oppose that decision. In fact, the only things I wrote at the time were about the logistical challenges and the political challenges associated with getting it done. I accepted it as a worthwhile, though not the goal I would have set for an incoming president in this space. And I always thought it was a bit of a tail wagging the dog. That is to say, the relevant question should be when and under what circumstances and according to what rules will you engage in military detention, not what the location of the facility in which you're going to do it is. And it always seemed to me that close Guantanamo was a way of talking about the location of a policy instead of the substance of the policy. To this day, I don't care if you do it at Guantanamo Bay or if you do it at somewhere else. The relevant question is, what are you doing and how are you doing it? And what rules are you willing to live by in the course of doing it? I observe that Guantanamo is not going away. The logistical problems that I was writing about, the political problems, actually turned out to be insurmountable given the president's willingness to put political energy into the subject, which was extremely limited. He was willing to issue an executive order on the second day in office. He was willing to give a speech at the National Archive a few months later. He was willing to make a few phone calls. Now he is not willing to talk about it at all unless asked in a press conference and caught off guard. And if that is the level of political energy that you are going to put into it, you're not going to get it done. And the sooner you acknowledge that, the better. Guantanamo isn't going away. It's not going away because Congress cares more about keeping it than the president cares about shutting it down. And that's all there is to the story. And anybody who tells you that there's more to the story than that is fooling themselves. So the question is, given that we're going to have Guantanamo, the question is, under what circumstances are we going to have Guantanamo? And here's the irony of what the president has done and why I think he actually deserves a lot of blame for this. Starting under the Bush administration and continuing under the Obama administration, there has been a revolution at Guantanamo. Guantanamo, while we were all talking about closing it, has turned into the exact sort of model facility that we talked about closing it in order to say we were going to create. So detainees at Guantanamo have access to counsel. They get to have their court cases. They get to file habeas cases to have an independent judge review their detentions. Those cases get reviewed all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. Journalists from all over the world visit and tour this facility. There is a lot of public evidence that gets released in the course of these habeas litigations. And once they are found to be properly detained, they are then have a continuing review process for as long as they are held there that's actually promises to be quite rigorous. And nobody really talks about this very much because we're all talking about how we should be closing it. And the question is, what are you closing it in order to do? Closing it in order to rebuild it somewhere else with presumably the same set of procedures that we now have there. And so what I think is that, you know, the president acknowledging that he is in fact not closing Guantanamo should rather embrace it and should say, look, I wanted to close this, but there is a coordinate branch of government that doesn't let me do that. And so what we've done is we've turned it from the thing that we objected to to the thing that we aspired for the circumstances of detention to be. And the irony is that if he made that argument, there would be certain process consequences to it, because there are a bunch of people being held elsewhere in the world who do not, though you in U.S. custody, do not have the same sort of generous rights that are now being granted to Guantanamo detainees. And so what I think, yes, is that we should bring anybody we're holding anywhere in the world in military detention, other than in certain very specific theater conflicts. But, you know, if we're holding people still foreign theater in Bagram, which we just turned over to the Afghans the other day, I think those people should be at Guantanamo, where they should get the benefit of the additional procedures that you get at Guantanamo that you don't get at the detention facility in Parwan. And I think a lot of good things would come, presumably in a second term, if we could have a little bit more of an honest conversation about Guantanamo, which is A, that it's not going away, and B, that we've really corrected the problems that made us want it to go away.
I can tell you, having just come from the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, that the rhetoric and policy on this was pretty much exactly as Ben stated. The Democratic platform continues to call for the closing of Guantanamo, though in a little bit less forceful way than it did 4 years ago, and the president said not a word about the issue in his convention speech.
Well, there was a wonderful article in The Onion the other day that, to the effect that all 168 Guantanamo detainees, one of them died over the weekend, so there's 167 now, but all 168 Guantanamo detainees were released into the Democratic Convention in Charlotte.
So if there's questions in the audience, we're prepared to go to those now. You can just raise your hand if you'd identify yourself and try to make it brief and make it actually a question as opposed to some sort of statement. This fellow way in the back seemed to be the first hand I saw.
Thank you. My name is Anshuman Apte, and I work for Voice of America Afghanistan Service. My question is about Afghanistan. How do you see positions of both the campaigns on Afghanistan and post 2014 transition as well?
Anyone want to jump in on that?
So the question was how.
On Afghanistan, what do you see as the positions of the two candidates, and how would the Afghanistan look different in the transition under the two different potential presidents?
Yeah, I think that there's, been some pressure on Romney to push for a longer transition. You know, I suspect that in the end, that either a President Obama in a second term or a President Romney in a first term would continue the current policy, which is to draw down in a way that hopefully leaves behind a Afghan security force that can take care of the challenges presented by the Taliban.
I mean, my view is that this is another area where Romney has straddled somewhat between the isolationist flank of his party and the more hawkish flank of the party. And, you know, he didn't mention, as we said, Afghanistan at all in his convention speech, which is kind of surprising given the 70,000 or so U.S. troops that are over there. And he's now been pointing to other speeches he's given where he says he's discussed the issue, but as I've blogged about several times, you go to those speeches and you don't actually find a discussion of the substance of the issue. You find him saying that we have 70,000 troops in Afghanistan, which is not a policy going forward. So, but I think that that's going to have to change somewhat, either in a speech that he's about to give, I think, as soon as tomorrow on security issues again, or certainly in these debates on foreign policy that we're going to hear during the month of October. This gentleman down here, wait for the microphone if you would.
My name is Joe Guggenheim, just an independent retired person. I'm just concerned about the U.S. policy on the use of drones in Yemen and Afghanistan and all. And I want to get your evaluation, the panel, whether the extent of that is helping or hurting in terms of eliminating the number of terrorists facing the United States, the negative impact of the drones versus the actual reality of how many terrorists we're getting, and anything, if you see what kind of changes might be made, if you agree that problem is getting worse because of the drones.
The president's first director of national intelligence, Dennis Blair, has made some headlines over the last year or so at various times by saying he thinks that essentially the blowback to aggressive use of the drones is causing more long-term damage for the U.S. than the short-term benefits. Ben, you'd start with you or anybody who wants to jump in.
Well, I don't really know how to evaluate that because, you know, there's the relatively easy question to evaluate is, are drones an effective way of killing the enemy? And the answer to that is pretty easy to answer. It's yes. And the reason these have become a very attractive tool of choice is that they can extend power into areas in which we do not have a significant troop footprint, and it can deliver with astonishing accuracy lethal force to by comparison to other means of attacking things that are quite remote, to very remote corners of the world. By most accounts that I've seen, including my co-authors, you know, the impact on the core enemy groups has been very substantial, both in terms of the occasional high-value kills, but probably more importantly in terms of the just devastation in an ongoing way of sort of the middle management of these groups. Now, I think to say that has been very effective, and I think most analysts agree that it has, raises this other question, which is the replenishing effect greater, lesser than, or about the same as the takeout effect? And I don't really know how to answer that in the short term. I think it is pretty clear to me that Al-Qaeda, the core of Al-Qaeda, has not replenished itself in a terribly effective way. It's not clear to me, though, that other groups are not coming up in this sort of splintering metastasis that's going on that will, in the long run, be as dangerous or more dangerous. And I think that's a sort of time will tell kind of question. I will say that as a strategic and political matter, it is very, very difficult for any president to say, while this is an effective strategy at neutralizing a threat that we face today, I'm going to forbear against the use of it because of the possibility that it may generate in the long run more people who dislike us and who will therefore constitute some greater threat in the long run. And this is, I think, part of the paradox of this conversation, which I actually don't disagree with anything my two colleagues have said about the sort of need to focus on governance, development, and poverty as big, big pieces of this puzzle. And similarly, they've both said, well, you know, they don't really disagree that there are these activities you have to engage in order to neutralize or deal with or capture or sometimes kill immediate term threats. And so you end up with this gnawing sense that these two ambitions are not necessarily in any immediate sense easily reconcilable with one another, and that some of the tools you're going to use are going to make it harder to use other tools. And yes, with respect to drone use, there is this open question, which is, you know, I do think if you, to go back to Josh's question, whether Guantanamo is the principal recruiting device of Al-Qaeda, no, right now drone use is, and that reflects the relative prevalence of it in our strategic arsenal right now.
A policy that is, or a strategy that is based mainly on drone use and ignoring all of the other factors will ultimately be self-defeating in the long run. You just have to be using more and more drones all the time.
The skies would be dark.
So that is my problem with the debate on the issue, is that everybody is just focusing on one aspect of the problem, which is the security aspect, and forgetting that in order to really defeat terrorism in the long run, you need to deal with the real causes of it. And these are the social, political, and economic.
In Obama's defense on this point, though, I do think, you know, he actually had an insight, whether a positive one or a negative one, quite a while ago. Everybody listened during the campaign when he talked about closing Guantanamo and restoring the rule of law and all of those other things that sound like bromides in retrospect. He was actually talking about strategic targeted killing during the campaign, too. In fact, he talked about it during one of the debates with McCain. He said to McCain very directly, you've said you'd follow Osama bin Laden to the gates of hell, but you won't even follow him to the cave that he lives in. We didn't know he lived in a city at the time, but somehow the compound that he lives in doesn't have the same word. I think, to be fair to Obama, he did come into office having articulated that he wanted to do a much more targeted, much more light footprint vision of operational counterterrorism. The problem that he was thinking of is, how do you take out the bad guys without invading whole countries? And I think a huge, big part of the answer, reason why the drone strategy developed the way it did, is it provides an answer to that question, albeit a very imperfect one.
Stephen, did you want to say something?
So I think we are left with this question of how to use the drones. It's clear we're going to use them. It's clear that they're highly lethal and effective. But it's clear they also have costs. And, they have costs. You can only imagine if drones were flying above us right now, the sense of violation that we would feel, the sense that we would have that our sovereignty is being infringed upon, and the outrage we would have if one of our relatives were accidentally killed as part of that. So you need to strike a balance. And my understanding is that from colleagues, I don't follow this issue as closely as they do, but my understanding from colleagues is that the number of strikes have gone down in Pakistan, in part out of recognition that there has been blowback because of civilian deaths and just because of the high usage of drones, and that we are using fewer drones right now in Pakistan and they're more targeted. Something that most people don't know about is most of the drone strikes now are in Yemen, where we are much more active and engaged than we have been in the past.
I think some of that drawdown or reduction in the number of strikes is also due to the tensions in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship in the wake of the incident where we killed several dozen of their troops by accident along the border as well. Back there.
Good afternoon. Dixon Osborne with Human Rights First. Ben, you suggested that whoever wins the election, the president's going to continue to invoke war powers as part of the counterterrorism operations. Does that mean that we are caught in a perpetual war frame ad infinitum? And if not, what does success look like in the war against al-Qaeda and affiliates?
It's an excellent sort of mother of all questions kind of question. Look, there are pieces of the war authorized by the AUMF that it is relatively easy to imagine a conceptual end to. The most obvious is that we are currently in fits and starts in a negotiation with the Taliban. The Taliban is one of the enemy groups. You could imagine a situation in which that I find it a little bit implausible, but at least in the short term. But you can imagine a situation in which you reached some sort of political accommodation. And for legal purposes, I think that would be the end of the conflict, at least vis-a-vis the Taliban. It is very hard to imagine a negotiated end to the portion of the conflict that is with al-Qaeda. And so the question is... you're really talking with al-Qaeda about what the circumstances in which you would acknowledge a defeat of al-Qaeda such that the war is, for legal and strategic purposes, over. Now, the Secretary of Defense on a number of occasions has said we're within a few deaths of strategic defeat of al-Qaeda. I have a feeling there were lawyers in the White House and the Pentagon who those statements made very, very nervous. I say that without any information, but if I were an attorney who had to argue that these war powers were available, having the Secretary of Defense walk around saying, we've almost got them, you know, is actually not. But that does sort of goes to your question. I mean, I think there's some point, and whether, you know, what the legal doctrine is when that point has been crossed, I don't think anybody really knows. Ultimately, the last thing the Supreme Court has said on the subject, which was after in the early 50s, after World War II, is it's a political question that the courts have no role in deciding. I kind of find it hard to believe. The further and further you get away from any point at which there's such a thing as al-Qaeda, and the more the president wants to rely on those war powers, I think the less legs a decision like that is going to have. On the other hand, that's sort of the state of it for now. We don't really know the answer to that question. And then the final component of your question is, what about these other affiliated groups? Since the administration interprets the authorization to authorize the use of force against al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces, right? So you can easy to imagine a conceptual end to the war with the Taliban, hard to imagine a negotiated end, but you could imagine a strategic defeat of al-Qaeda. And then there are all these associated forces, and that raises a very tricky question. If you defeat al-Qaeda, what does it mean to be associated with it, right? And this is very uncharted legal territory, both as a domestic law matter and as an international law matter, and I think we just don't know the answer to it yet. I certainly don't purport to.
If we came to a point where strategic defeat was, for whatever reason, announced by the U.S., what would be the implications of that? Because, for example, President Clinton fired missiles at bin Laden before we had the AUMF.
Right.
Would it mean that if suddenly an al-Awlaki-type figure popped up, we'd have to send a force in to try to arrest him rather than hit him with a drone or drop a bomb on him? Or would it just only matter to the various lawyers and international law scholars who like to debate these issues?
Well, so, I mean, the answer is you would remove statutory authorization for any military activity once you say that war is over. The president, of course, claims, as do all presidents, the inherent power under Article 2 of the Constitution and under the self-defense doctrine of under international law, under the UN Charter, to protect the country against imminent threats. And so there's some residual latent power to respond to threats that new threats that arise. I think the, you know, this is actually the reason I can, one of the, Dan and I conclude the paper by, or part of the conclusion is that Mitt Romney during the primaries actually articulated an idea that is very worth the next president's, whether it's Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, taking very seriously, which is the idea of really rewriting the AUMF to describe the conflict that we're actually still fighting rather than the one that we started fighting 10 years ago and we've, as Dixon says, attenuated rather far from. And I'm sure he wouldn't speak for him, but I suspect he wouldn't support that particular idea. I do think there's a lot to be said for the idea of having an authorizing document for the conflict that's sort of responsive to the conflict that you actually see yourself on a day-to-day level prosecuting.
I was just going to say that
this
would not make the lawyers very happy. It would be confusing. But my own vision of the end game is when al-Qaeda ceases to be a relevant part of the conversation in the Muslim world. And I think largely through actions not of our own, but through because of the Arab Spring, I think we've moved closer to that, where ordinary citizens in the Arab world have found that it's far more effective to go out to the streets peacefully than to blow yourself up as a suicide bomber. That there's another way of charting a future path and of getting rid of these authoritarian leaders that have really mucked things up for so long.
Let's try to get another question in here from this gentleman here in the front.
Jagdish Chandra, George Washington University. We have been talking all the time about the Middle East. Of course, underlying, we are talking about Islamic groups and so on. 70% of the Muslims, Islamic populations, they live in Indonesia, Turkey, South Asia, and so on. And Obama and this administration's image there is very high. Pakistan, there are certain problems in Pakistan. But in general, in the last 3.5 years, the kind of image and relationship that Clinton and Obama have been nurturing is extremely good. So there are some intrinsic problems in Middle East which I think should not cloud the successes that Obama has gotten in this area.
Hafez or Stephen, do you have any insight as to why, is what the gentleman says correct, and if
yes.
So, why is that?
Yes, and it's actually a very important point, because I think Indonesia in particular is a very good example that we should be looking at when we study what is happening in the Middle East, because Indonesia went through the same process. With an autocratic leader, with a crisis, with very strong Islamist groups, and very strong political Islam. The first elected president in Indonesia was also an Islamist. And as the country has been more and more successful, both on the economic transition, following the fall, the fall of Suharto, and following the East Asian crisis, and also on the democratic transition, where they had, three successful elections with a change in leadership. We see exactly that a country that's becoming much more stable, more prosperous, and with excellent relations with the West. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from the experiences of Asian countries, and particularly Indonesia, because of the similarities in culture, religion, and even the structure of the economy.
And these are places where al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda operatives have, in at least historically speaking, taken refuge and carried out even
major terrorist attacks.
Major terrorist attacks.
You had the Bali bombings in Indonesia.
In Bali.
But you had a very robust government effort to shut down the extremists within Indonesia.
Okay. I think maybe we can do one final question. This lady back there in the next to Dixon. Thanks.
Hi, Amanda Batista, student at American University. My question is, in terms of long-term counterterrorism efforts made by the U.S., how important is the American image, particularly in Middle Eastern states? And if the American image or reputation is important, how can we make it better? Is it through drones or is it through our financial purse strings?
How central is the U.S. to this discussion? I mean, can we have the Arab Spring and the terrorism debate take place without Uncle Sam automatically being the face of part of this debate?
I think the U.S. has a role to play, a very important, a critical role to play in the region and in those countries. However, as we said, I think Steve was saying earlier, it has, because of the history and the baggage, it has, at least in the short run, it needs to be quite subtle. Most of the population in the Arab Spring countries, in Tunisia and Egypt, Yemen, and so on, were asked, they do not want to see U.S. support to political institutions in the country, for example. Which is normal. I mean, you wouldn't want to see Yemeni support to political institutions in the United States either. So the U.S. has to play a role of supporting democracy in general, has to try to build more, even in its economic work, it needs to build more ties with the people, with civil society, with trying to reach directly the poor and the beneficiaries of the projects, and as much as possible, try to stay a bit in the background and not be pushing too hard. The peoples in those countries are mature. They know what they want. And they can do it on their own with some help from their friends, and I think that this is really really the main point is that we should just leave those people have started the process, which is important. They need some help in that process, not all from the United States, but from others also. From international organizations, from different countries, from amongst themselves, regional cooperation among the different countries in the region, which is actually very weak. So they can learn from other countries like Indonesia, as we mentioned. And so the United States needs to reconsider a little bit how it operates. In those countries and the types of relations it wants to build. Finally, there is still an important. I think that the Arab-Israeli conflict is always going to be a source of instability, and that is an area where the U.S. can play an important role in trying to bring out a peaceful solution there.
So we're going to start to conclude here. My concluding question has to do with the fact that tomorrow is the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And I'm wondering if you gentlemen think that the debate or discussion over these terrorism-related issues here in the U.S. has matured, become more detached, become more thoughtful and strategic as time has gone on. And is there any prospect for us seeing any of that in a helpful way or a way that advances the policies as opposed to sort of demagoguing them as we go into this hard-fought last 7 or 8 weeks of this campaign?
Well, I think the general answer, unfortunately, is no. The answer to any question, you know, can you expect a really mature discussion of the issue X in the last hard-fought weeks of the campaign is presumptively no. But particularly an issue like this, which is, you know, we talk about sort of in two modes. One is the mode that's sort of distant from a major event like this one, and the other is the mode where, you know, something awful has just happened. In the former situation, as we've seen in the campaign, we just don't engage it. And I think we can expect very little discussion of this issue other than, by the way, do you remember that I killed Osama bin Laden? And a lot of, yeah, I would have done that too. But beyond that, I sort of doubt that we're going to have a lot of discussion of it unless something terrible happens, in which case I think we can reasonably expect the quality of the discussion to be exceedingly immature and unserious. And so I actually don't think there's a lot of reason for confidence in the American political debate in electoral terms in this. The good news is that beneath the surface, there's actually, a much more serious conversation, and fortunately, that can sometimes create groundworks for policy that you wouldn't know from the sort of gestalt surface conversation is really available.
Stephen, any thoughts?
Gallup has asked since 9/11 of Americans, how much do you know about Muslims and Islam? And the response has been consistently, unfortunately, for the last 11 years, I haven't seen the most recent data, but about half of Americans say not much or nothing at all. And I think that is a tragedy and one area where we really haven't made progress since 9/11. Since 9/11, American Muslims have really been the other in American culture, and I think that is unfortunate because of how it redounds on us as a country, how we're perceived internationally, and just in terms of the plight of an important community in America.
Hafez, any thoughts?
Maybe because I'm not following it as closely as my colleagues, I'm just an economist. I get the impression, well, that the debate has matured. It is nowhere near where it ought to be, because it tends to focus on very much on the short term with no strategy of how are we going to get out of this. But compared to 10 years ago, to 9 years ago, I think that there is the debate has matured, and that people look at different aspects of the problem. Now, that does not mean that what my other two colleagues just said is wrong. No, but maybe I'm just seeing the glass as half full rather than half empty.
I think maybe the debates might actually serve to produce at least some discussion, which by itself might be somewhat useful, of these issues, if only because of the power of TV time and a national audience and the vacuum. If they're really going to devote one or one and a half debates to these issues, they'll simply run out of time if they don't try to cover the Arab Spring and terrorism and some of these national security issues. So we may actually see perhaps an interesting, if not a robust debate, at least some of the issues discussed, because as you mentioned, Ben, the president doesn't seem to want to talk about some aspects of this debate unless he's asked about it directly. And Mitt Romney up till now has shown almost no interest in discussing these issues publicly. The two men may find they have little choice but to do that because of the focusing power of these debates. I'd like to thank everybody for coming who's here in the room and everybody on C-SPAN or watching on the Internet who's joined us for this discussion. And on behalf of Brookings and the panelists, thank you for being here. And thanks a lot. Take care.